This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Futuro.
In July of 2020, 4 months before the presidential election, Robert Unanue, the CEO of Goya Foods, gave a speech at the White House.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. Good afternoon, everyone. It's such an honor and such a blessing to be here in the greatest country in the world.
He talked about Goya's mission and growth through the years, from being a small bodega in New York City's Lower East Side to now a billion-dollar corporation. And then Unanue changed the script.
We're all truly blessed at the same time to have a leader like President Trump, who is a builder. We pray for our leadership, our president, and we pray for our country.
And at that moment, Robert Unanue's support for Donald Trump put his company, Goya, and its products at the center of a brief but pretty intense political controversy. You might remember the viral photo of Ivanka Trump where she's holding a can of Goya beans. At the same time, opposing hashtags like Goya Away were trending online, and there were calls for a boycott of all the company's products, especially among Latinos and Latinas. Latino leaders like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and playwright Lin-Manuel Miranda advocated for people to reconsider purchasing Goya Foods.
Do not expect a community that feels victimized by Donald Trump and attacked by Donald Trump constantly, and that is your loyal consumer base, not to react and feel hurt when they see you praising that person.
But Goya also had its advocates. Like Ivanka Trump, many threw their support behind the company, dismissing the boycott.
Cancel culture strikes again. Goya Foods CEO is refusing to apologize in the face of a liberal boycott of his food company.
This country is too fat to boycott a food company. This is a top 10 dinner item for most families.
And some of the loudest critics of the boycott were Goya's main distributors, bodega owners, many of whom are Latinos and Latinas as well.
Goya Foods will remain on our shelves, and our community will continue to buy Goya products. Goya is in our community para siempre.
Viva Goya!
Today!
Well, it turns out this was not the first time that Goya, the giant food company, had found itself in the middle of a controversy. And just like before, it was about much more than just a can of beans. From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, Goya in three boycotts. Goya is a giant in the United States food industry. Today, the company is worth over $1 billion and employs over 4,000 people in dozens of factories throughout the country and abroad. It's also a staple in Latino homes across the U.S. The Latino community is a huge part of Goya's consumer base. After Goya Foods CEO Robert Unanue spoke in the White House Rose Garden last summer, producer Gabriel Berbe realized she had a lot of questions about the brand receiving all of this attention. Gabriel started digging into Goya itself, the family behind the brand, and some of the past controversies that the company has weathered. Through Gabriel's reporting, she discovered a common theme repeating itself over the years, something bigger than any single news headline. Goya is more than pantry staples and spices to its customers. Specifically, its Latino customers. For many Latinos and Latinas, Goya is like a badge of identity. So that's a pretty tall order for a company. Hey, Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Maria.
So, Gabriel, tell us what happened that you were like, I need to spend some more time thinking about Goya food products, and that this led you down a kind of rabbit hole.
So, Maria, before the boycott, I had no idea who the Unanue family was. I grew up with Goya beans, but didn't know or never really thought about how this company became a symbol of Latino identity in the U.S. Clearly, it wasn't about how much people love their beans or adobo. It was something much deeper than that. Goya evokes emotions for many Latinos. And in researching Goya, I found three separate boycotts spanning decades where Goya's carefully crafted image as a symbol of Latino identity was thrown into question. One in Miami, one in New York and Puerto Rico, and the other one from the summer. And together, they helped tell a not-so-rosy story about this powerful company. But before I jump in, it's important to understand the history of the brand and how the Unanue family used their immigrant background to craft their business image.
Okay, so we know that Goya was founded in the 1930s by Don Prudencio Unanue and his wife, Carolina. And Don Prudencio was actually a merchant from Spain.
Right. He arrived in Puerto Rico from Spain in 1902, then moved to the United States and started a small business in New York City, importing goods from Spain. That business eventually became Goya Foods. Robert Unanue, Goya's current CEO, often tells his grandfather's story.
He missed taste from home, and he had an idea that other immigrants also missed taste from home.
Don Prudencio started importing goods like olive oil and other canned fish products to his shop on the Lower East Side, serving the Spanish immigrant community.
But Goya then ends up being really a Latino brand for the entire population. I mean, it grows. And this is, you know, their primary customers are Latinos and Latinas. So tell us the story of how Don Prudencio becomes so successful in expanding this business.
Well, after World War II, U.S. factory owners took advantage of the depression in Puerto Rico to outsource cheap labor from the island. And in a span of just 1 year, the Puerto Rican population in New York City nearly quadrupled from 13,000 to over 50,000 people. I spoke with Puerto Rican food historian Professor Cruz Miguel Ortiz Cuadra about how Unanue capitalized on this migration wave to grow his business.
The political and economical transformation that occurred in Puerto Rico in the 1940s opened a huge big door to Unanue. The success of Goya Foods and its entanglement with Puerto Rican food habits and culinary traditions was at his doorstep. And make no mistake, immigrant himself, Unanue knew that this big first migration would travel with its food memories.
Wow. Food memories. I mean, that's a great concept, right? This notion of, you know, eating rice and beans as a kid, or tortillas, or, you know, making fresh tamales over the holidays with your family. I mean, there is this thing, food memories, and we all have them.
Yeah, it's this idea that food is personal. Professor Ortiz Cuadra often refers to this term food or palate memories. He first coined the term in his book, Eating Puerto Rico, and he uses this concept to describe the intimate bond with food formed by cultural and historical practices. So, this idea that the food we eat reflects our values, choices, and culture, and it's central in understanding Goya's rise.
So, more Puerto Ricans moved into New York City, and there was the experience of racism and xenophobia that a lot of outsider communities experience. Puerto Ricans are not immigrants, right? Because they're just moving from one part of the United States to another part of the United States. But as it was in New York City, that wasn't welcoming to many Puerto Ricans. I mean, that increases the need for food to be a place where you find solace and comfort, right?
Exactly.
Food is so, so important. It can trace you back to your homeland. Goya became the food link to the homeland and to the food traditions of Puerto Ricans in the diaspora.
Don Prudencio continued to build Goya around the city's growing immigrant community from Latin America. He knew that capitalizing on food memories was a powerful business strategy. His grandson, Robert, talked about this in an interview.
You know, what a lot of people feel is when an immigrant comes into this country, they'll soon switch over to American cuisine, hot dogs and hamburgers and things like that. But food is a deep tradition for most immigrants. And that's what makes the brand and our cuisine so powerful to the immigrant community, is that tie to homeland and cuisine.
It was basically a brand strategy that Goya embarked on in a very big way. And essentially, it worked.
Slowly but steadily, Goya became a staple of not just Puerto Rican kitchens, but Latino households all across the U.S.
They are gaining lots of money, taking the advantage of the palate and the memory palate, not only of Puerto Ricans, but also of Caribbean and Central American migrations to the USA.
By 1980, Goya had over 1,000 employees and expanded their operations across the country. Su excelencia, la salsa de más venta. And this is where my research took a turn into the crazy world of Goya archives. In this growth in the 70s and 80s, Goya began producing these television advertisements. They even had their own show, El Super Show Goya.
El Super Show Goya. Con libreto y actuación del animador.
They had cooking shows with big names like Celia Cruz.
I actually remember seeing that commercial and remember Celia Cruz doing that little dance as she's like, I got the sazón.
I know, that ad was pretty catchy. Goya started to build a really compelling narrative of their business empire. They created a brand off of the idea of being part of the American dream, for Latinos in particular. In the 1980s, immigration from Latin America soared even more, and Goya's growth followed. They started selling empanadas for the Colombian community in New York and Miami, and refried beans and salsa for the Mexican community in Texas and on the West Coast. The business, its workers, and its consumers became known as La Gran Familia Goya, the Grand Goya Family.
Okay, so where do the boycotts begin to fit in this story?
Well, Maria, this claim to family status, it came at a cost. In 1998, the image of the happy family of La Gran Familia Goya was thrown into question. And for the first time in the public spotlight, Goya was caught up in an ugly dispute with its employees. They were mostly Latino immigrants working in Goya's regional Florida factory in Miami, and they were trying to unionize to improve working conditions. This dispute raised the question, what did it mean to be part of the Gran Goya family?
The level of arrogance of this family, it was almost like they were running a plantation, and these were the indentured servants on the plantation.
Coming up on Latino USA, Goya faces its first public boycott. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino.
Thank you.
Hey, we're back. And when we left off, a group of immigrant workers at Goya's factory in Miami challenged Goya's carefully crafted narrative of La Gran Familia Goya, which means the Grand Goya Family. And Gabriel is going to pick up the story from here.
Goya's factory in Miami-Dade County was a pillar for the food company. It supplied Goya products to the major grocery stores throughout the state of Florida. On the wall of the large Miami warehouse, there was a painting that read, La Gran Familia Goya, Juntos Hoy y en el Nuevo Milenio. The Grand Goya Family, Together Now and in the New Millennium. It was painted in Goya's large signature blue lettering. Rodolfo Chavez, a truck driver who worked for Goya for nearly a decade, was part of this family. Or at least, he thought he was.
My name is Rodolfo Chavez. I'm originally from Nicaragua. I left Nicaragua in 1984.
Rodolfo came to the United States when he was 17. Maria, his high school sweetheart from Nicaragua, eventually joined him in California, and they got married. After 5 years, Rodolfo, his wife, and their baby daughter drove from Los Angeles to Miami in search of better job opportunities.
We were starting to go through the America dream, and we was working as a handyman, whatever we can do, we do it. But later on, a friend of us got me a job in Goya Food, Florida.
Rodolfo started working as a truck driver for Goya, delivering goods throughout most of South Florida.
The truck was very old trucks. Going 4 o'clock in the morning from Miami to Naples.
And even though he was in Florida, Rodolfo remembers how chilly some of those early mornings were.
That truck didn't have no heater. The wind go through, even though you close the window, but you can feel the breeze from outside.
And during those first few years, Rodolfo enjoyed working at Goya.
They make us feel like a family, like they said, the big family Goya. And it was nice at the beginning. It was very nice.
Rodolfo liked his coworkers and had a good relationship with his boss. Most of the people he worked with were also immigrants, mainly from Cuba and the Dominican Republic, and they were mostly Latino men. He said he felt supported by everyone at the plant and said he felt grateful for this job. But then the company appointed Mary Ann Unanue, the third generation of Unanues, to run Goya, to head the Florida operations.
She came and she have a new point of view of business. And she started doing a lot of changes.
Those changes included cutting back on worker pensions and benefits, shortening their vacation times, eliminating overtime, and most notably, cutting back on operation costs, which led to this infestation of rats, mice, and roaches in the warehouse.
And there was mice all over. We deal as a truck driver because when they pull a pallet inside, something jumping from the pallet. Something jump on you, and that's what you guys care. They jump into you. So we deal with that, and we told the company about it. But they didn't care, so no.
This rat infestation was only one problem on top of many that Goya's workers began facing. Their hours became longer, their time off was cut short while their paychecks were cut, and every time they tried to speak up about it, they experienced pushback from Goya's management. Fed up with the declining working conditions, Goya's workers started a campaign to unionize in the Miami operation and fight for better working conditions, which included better hours, better pension, retirement plans, and sanitary warehouse protocols.
So I joined the union. And then we presented to the company, we asked for a body to take place. And that's when Goya started a very, very rough campaign against the union.
At first, Goya refused to recognize the workers' demands to join the union, known as Unite. So the workers took their demands to the public.
And we marched, we did a march.
Rodolfo, along with the other workers who were part of the union negotiations, they held a demonstration outside of a Winn-Dixie supermarket in Miami. It's one of Goya's largest distributors in the region. During the march, three Goya workers went inside the supermarket and asked the manager to sign a petition listing their demands.
Goya found out the same day, of course. and they knew who was inside. So those people, they didn't, next day they came to work, they got fired.
Goya fired three of Rodolfo's coworkers after that incident for making a scene at the supermarket. And in the Miami warehouse, they became known as the Winn-Dixie Three. Latino USA reached out to Goya about the incident, but the company didn't respond. The firing of the Winn-Dixie Three became this cautionary tale for any of Goya's workers who tried to push union negotiations further.
During this time, you know, the union effort to organize, and we was it was getting low. The animosity of the worker was frustration. It was very, because of all the change, because of the fire employee, and they fired a couple more, I don't remember exactly, but I know they, especially because of the Winn-Dixie Trio, everything went down the drain. But they didn't care about workers. They only care about losing their power, power to fire you whenever they want, power to change you, your benefit whenever they would like. And that's what it is, you know, most about power.
After his friends got fired, Rodolfo's belief in the union's mission just got stronger. He kept wearing his union shirt, visible under his Goya uniform. And eventually, a little over a year after the Winn-Dixie incident, Rodolfo got a call.
Well, there was a conversation with dispatcher. The dispatcher told me, no, you don't have no rap tomorrow. You had to go and see Maria Cristina, which was the HR. When they told me that, I said, I was fired. I'm fired. It was kind of pressure that night, and talked to my wife and said, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I guess I lost my job. And, you know, it was kind of frustration after 10 years, almost 10 years. And that day, it was like my world, my American dream went down the drain because you are so used to working on a play for so many years. That you don't think about, you think about the future. The future will be hard.
Rodolfo said the company told him he was fired for being insubordinate. And Rodolfo was one of several Goya workers, including the Winn-Dixie Three, who Goya fired for trying to unionize. A battle for settlements ensued, and the whole thing got even uglier. The negotiations lasted 16 years. And in 2014, the National Labor Relations Board finally charged Goya with 15 violations of the National Labor Relations Act. And Goya had to pay over $3 million to the NLRB to distribute to the employees who were wronged. The regional director of the union, Harris Rayner, stepped into negotiations with Goya on behalf of the current and fired workers.
They went after those long-term employees, not only to get rid of them, but to send a message to all the other employees that if you stand up for your rights, here's what's going to happen to you. And those employees were engaged in something that was later called protected concerted activity, which is when employees act together to achieve an end that's legal, and they act in a legal manner, and the company punishes them illegally for exercising their rights.
These charges included illegally disciplining employees by withholding wage increases and taking away benefits, ignoring worker complaints about unsanitary working conditions, taking away pension and benefit plans. But when Rayner stepped in to bring Goya to the bargaining table with the union, Goya wouldn't budge.
They clearly felt like these employees had no right to ask for anything, to organize, to have a union. I mean, I've never seen such dictatorship. The level of arrogance of this family, it was almost like they were running a plantation and these were the indentured servants on the plantation.
Rayner also brought up another point that highlighted the further hypocrisy of Goya's mistreatment of its workers in the factory.
And then they felt like that because they were Spanish-speaking, and most of the employees were from Latin countries, that they could just talk to them separately and try to flim-flam them and lie to them and manipulate them in any way that they could. It's an incredible story of arrogance and social class.
After the union made complaints to the National Labor Relations Board, Rayner cited cases where the Unanways themselves lied to the terminated employees. The Unanways told the fired employees, that the union had lost the case and the judge decided against them. They did this to convince these former employees to sign settlement agreements, which then allowed Goya to privately settle disputes on their own terms rather than giving workers a fair chance of representation. Efforts to negotiate a union contract with Goya lasted years and eventually petered out. It's a common tactic to squash unionizing efforts. Draw out the negotiation process long enough for support for the union to die out. And that's exactly what happened. The efforts to negotiate a union contract did die out after a 16-year deadlock. Goya never agreed to a union contract in the Miami plant, and Rodolfo never got his job back. In fact, most of the workers who were fired during that period had their benefit and retirement plans taken away and never received settlements from Goya.
They don't care about customers. They don't care about workers. They just care about making a profit. There's only a few families that lived through the agony of Goya, the family Goya.
After the Miami protests, the Goya brand remained mostly out of a critical spotlight. The boycott and labor disputes hadn't amounted to damaging the company's reputation, and Goya continued expanding their brand rapidly in the U.S. throughout the 2000s. But over a decade later, in 2017, Goya once again found itself entangled in another controversy. This time, it was with the Puerto Rican community in New York. The Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York City is one of the city's largest parades. Every June, 35 blocks in Manhattan are closed and flooded with Puerto Rican music, dancing, and floats. The parade is sponsored by big corporations like Coca-Cola, Google, JetBlue, and Goya had been a sponsor since the inaugural parade in 1958. They even had their own Goya float and dancers in the lineup every year. But that all changed in 2017 because of a controversy over a man named Oscar Lopez Rivera.
Organizers of New York's Puerto Rican Day Parade are being criticized for honoring a convicted terrorist, Oscar Lopez Rivera, who was recently pardoned by President Obama. Sponsors of the parade pulling out. AT&T, Coca-Cola, JetBlue, Goya, and even the Yankees have all removed their support.
Lopez Rivera is a controversial figure. He was a leader of the Armed Forces of National Liberation, a group that advocated for independence of Puerto Rico. He also spent 35 years in prison for being accused of conspiracy to overthrow the United States government. But after the FBI failed to connect him to a threat of bombings carried out in the name of the pro-independence group, people began calling for his release. In 2017, President Obama commuted Rivera's sentence. So when the organizers of the Puerto Rican Day Parade named the 2017 event in honor of Lopez Rivera, these corporations essentially boycotted the parade. But what they didn't expect was a boycott to their boycott. Here's artist Isabel Turner and her mother at that parade.
Everybody's waving a flag, blasting music from cars, people are singing on top of floats. It just makes my heart feel so warm to see so many people filled with so much pride for their homeland.
But that year, the parade was different for Isabel and many other Puerto Ricans. Parade organizers and many in the Puerto Rican community were calling to boycott Goya products after the company pulled its sponsorship. So this is what I'm talking about, the boycott of the boycott. And Isabel joined in.
I think the main thing was people saying, you're Goya, you're an iconic symbol for the Puerto Rican community. Like, how could you leave? Like, how could you drop out of this?
For Isabel, Goya pulling out of this parade led to a larger realization about the company's role in her life. Goya was more than just a pantry staple for her. It was a means to make these dishes that feel like home and bind families together.
Whenever I think of family events, I always think of my mom making arroz con gandules, which is a Puerto Rican rice dish that normally requires a can of Goya beans. Or Christmas time, we'll have coquito, and that will normally get the cream of coconut from a Goya can. So I started thinking about how Goya is just such a integral, almost part of my identity, or that for so long I thought of it as something that was really ingrained in who I was and who I was as a Puerto Rican.
But at this point, boycotting Goya products wasn't enough for Isabel. She began asking deeper questions.
Who is behind these products? Whose cultures have been boiled down to fit into these packaged goods? If Goya is so ingrained and such a part of the family, should it be given the status of a family member?
And as an artist and photographer, she turned to art as a way of processing what had happened at the 2017 parade. It led to this entire photography series called Tiene que ser bueno, translating to It Has to Be Good, Goya's most popular marketing slogan. At first, Tiene que ser bueno looks like a colorful shrine to Goya with canned vegetables and Goya prayer candles laid out on an altar of banana leaves. But you have to look closer and see what Isabel is really doing here. She dug through hundreds of negatives of old photographs of her family. She selected photos like a black and white portrait of her mother's first communion in Puerto Rico, this weathered, early colored photograph of her aunts in grade school, posing on a playground in front of a tenement building in the Bronx. She took these precious heirlooms and neatly reprinted them onto the labels of Goya cans. So at first, the cans just look like what you'd see at a bodega. But look closer, and you'll see photos of Isabel's family on each can. The most jarring part of Isabel's metaphor here is that every face is covered with a white price tag.
My culture has a monetary value now because a corporation decided that once upon a time, maybe they had good intentions and they wanted to sell packaged goods, but they progressed so far from that now, and they've decided that they were going to sell culture. I wanted people to see that, like, oh, I could buy this. Oh, I could take this. Oh, this is for sale. Oh, this is for sale. Oh, this family picture, that's for sale. These cultures have become commodities.
Isabel also saw that Goya had created this strong association between their products and the American dream. They even state this mission on their website. But Isabel believes that Puerto Ricans have never been granted the American dream. And she felt that Goya never really cared about the relentless hardships the Puerto Rican community and even the larger Latino community has faced. The 2017 parade was Isabel's aha moment, and she hasn't looked back since.
It was also a death or a goodbye to Goya in a lot of ways. Goodbye to that chapter of them being my iconic symbol for my culture. This alignment with Goya as the icon of culture, Puerto Rican culture, Latinx culture, it doesn't work.
By 2017, Goya was already a household product for all Americans, not just Latinos. The company exceeded $1 billion in revenue in 2018. Just like with the boycott from the Goya workers in Miami 20 years before, the one after the 2017 parade died out. And then, in 2020, another reckoning came. And this one gained a ton of attention.
We're all truly blessed at the same time to have a leader like President Trump, who is a builder.
After Goya's president expressed his support for Donald Trump, I wanted to know what these boycotts looked like within the Latino community in the context of a global pandemic. Latinos were experiencing a coronavirus death rate nearly three times higher than white Americans and a disproportionately high rate of unemployment compared to the national average. Black and brown Latinos especially had a lot more to worry about at the time than whether or not to buy Goya products. I still saw Goya on the shelves of grocery stores and bodegas, and I wanted to know if these calls for a boycott were really resonating with Latinos, the community that Goya says it's for and represents. Or was it all just noise? A few weeks after Unanue's comments, I met a bar owner in San Francisco's Mission District who had stopped buying Goya for her restaurant.
It felt kind of shitty, to be honest. I don't know. I'm not going to lie, it kind of was like a punch to my gut. Like, my favorite black beans were Goya. And I made a conscious choice not to purchase them after that.
This is Marisol Gonzalez. We met at Lupulandia, the Mexican bar she opened in November of 2019 on Mission Street. The space is colorful, bright pink and blue paintings line the wall, and this massive mural of a Xolo, the Mexican hairless dog breed, reaches the high ceilings over the bar.
Food is everything. So when we were able to open a restaurant that can highlight Mexican flavors, like things that I think my mom would enjoy, is everything.
Marisol used Goya products to make these dishes, from the seasoning for their rice dishes to Goya beans for their tacos. But after they decided to boycott Goya, Marisol and her husband turned to making food from scratch, at home and at the restaurant.
And I always say, like, my mom used to make this for me. Like, this was, like, something that I used to love. And, you know, even Anthony remembers his grandma making fideo for him. There's just certain things that kind of, I don't know, they not only do they taste delicious, but they, like, remind you of certain things. Like, there's this nostalgia for, like, yeah, I remember my mom used to make this for me, so now I want to do that for my kid. And I want him to be connected to my mom through this food as well.
And Marisol kept adhering to this boycott, even through the devastating economic downturn the pandemic had caused.
So business was doing well. People responded really well to the food. So yeah, Lupulandia was becoming the place that we wanted it to be. And then COVID hit and the city shut us down. From one day to the other, we essentially had to close down the place. And it was a little heartbreaking.
I mean, this was her reality. An unprecedented pandemic was threatening her livelihood and the restaurant she had always dreamed of opening. She boycotted Goya, and then what? With the bar facing closure, Marisol didn't have the time or energy to ask this question, then what? She even admitted that she didn't know how tenable the boycott was, with bodegas and restaurants struggling to stay open. So many had already closed in the city. And it made me wonder whether this boycott was serving any larger purpose. What was the point of all this? I kept thinking back to this idea that the food historian, Professor Ortiz Cuadra, brought up.
Food is so, so important. It can trace you back to your homeland.
The idea that food memories are the foundation of our intimate connections with our culture and identity.
Remembering food, it solidifies your identity in processes of diasporas.
I asked Professor Ortiz Cuadra if this identity through food can ever be reclaimed. And he did tell me about one movement in Puerto Rico that is trying to do just that.
There is a flourishing, if I can say that, of young people, professionals, that are returning back to agriculture, specifically small agriculture. And it's a way to step away on the margins of this food capitalism, particularly because Puerto Rico has a big problem of imports. 85-88% of our food is imported. So this movement is trying to make or plant or produce foodstuffs that are very essential in our cooking and in our palate.
And this movement isn't only happening in Puerto Rico. It's happening everywhere. From urban farming movements in California to food sovereignty movements in Cuba, the takeaway is this commitment to reforming relationship with food, it's hard. And it takes sacrifice. In this process, it doesn't happen overnight. Everyone involved in these boycotts, they realized that Goya had capitalized on their emotional connection to food for its own corporate profit. And they tried to do something about it. For Rodolfo, Goya's promise of being part of La Gran Familia, of achieving the American dream through the food company, was a lie. And he fought back. The Puerto Rican artist, Isabel, divorced her Puerto Rican identity from Goya after recognizing the ways in which the food company had embedded itself in her relationship with her culture. Marisol took Goya's support for Donald Trump as a betrayal against the community it claims to serve and honored that boycott, even while facing imminent closure of her restaurant. If Goya's meteoric expansion in the U.S. is due to the brand's uncanny ability to represent the entire Latino community in the U.S., that also seems to be one of the company's biggest flaws. And reinventing these food memories, as Professor Ortiz Cuadra calls them, it can start small, like in your kitchen. That's how Isabel is getting started, by making her own sofrito from scratch and memorizing her mom's recipe by heart.
My mom puts 3 to 4 cloves of garlic, 1 onion, normally small or medium, depending, 1 green pepper, or you can use 1 red pepper, because you can either make red sofrito or green sofrito, but occasionally my mom will do half of a green pepper, half of a red, then 1/2 cup of olive oil, and then 2 cups of cilantro.
This episode was produced by Gabrielle Burbet and Alejandra Salazar and edited by Marta Martinez. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Julieta Martinelli, Alisa Escarce, Ginny Montalvo, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raul Perez. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw, with help from Alicia Baitu. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our interns are Samantha Friedman and Carly Rubin. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and the Wincote Foundation.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, En la Boca del Lobo, what Mexican researchers learned about how asylum seekers forced by the U.S. to wait in Mexico are surviving while in the mouth of the wolf. That's next time on Latino USA.